Support for our podcast comes from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, offering precision cancer treatment guided by advanced genomic testing through its new Centers for Advanced Individual Medicine. Advanced genomic testing may reveal treatment options that were not considered previously. Learn more at cancercenter.com.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It sounds like a Halloween horror story. A flesh-eating parasite, long thought dead, returns to infect beloved endangered wildlife. But it is real. So the screwworm is back, the parasitic fly larva, named for the long corkscrewing path it chews through living tissue. Sounds really awful. And 100 years ago, it was a pest that cost the livestock industry millions of dollars per year. But then scientists in the 1940s began an effort to eradicate them with a now common tool, millions and millions of sterile male flies. And it worked. The United States hasn't been an established population of screwworms since 1982. Haven't seen that, but now it's been spotted on half a dozen of Florida's keys. Bad news for the endangered key deer. Since late September, a crisis has been unfolding for the little deer. More than 100 have been euthanized because of untreatable screwworm infections, and there are only about 1,000 deer left in the entire population. So, can the key deer survive? How did the screwworm get back there in the first place? And can we banish it again? That's what we're going to be talking about. Let me introduce my guests. Dr. Philip Kaufman is an associate professor of veterinary entomology at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida. Chris Eggleston is acting manager at the National Key Deer Refuge on Big Pine Key. And an all hands-on-deck effort to save the deer is underway. Welcome, Dr. Kaufman, and welcome, Chris, to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Dr. Kaufman, this sounds like a horrifying little parasite.
It is, and it's something we haven't seen in this country, as you said, in over 30 years. The fly is very aggressive when it does establish an infestation. And it is something we need to take seriously and are taking seriously.
How does it kill the deer?
Well, so an infestation will start wherever there's any open wound is the most likely place. And so the female fly will sense that. She'll find that host, lay her eggs on it. Those eggs hatch and the larvae begin burrowing into the animal. What makes this fly different than all the other blowflies we have is that it specifically goes after the living tissue and burrows deeper and deeper. And as it burrows, it creates more of a wound. That wound draws in more flies. And when those infestations get large enough or extensive enough and they get to a sensitive area where maybe they get into the organs or open wounds that can't be healed, the animals will die. And it may take 7 to 14 days. But untreated, this is a very deadly condition.
Chris, you're on the ground in the Keys. Why, what do you see? Do you see them being ravaged by the screwworm?
Yeah, well, it's been a really tragic situation down here. This started back in the sort of late summer and started to get progressively worse, where we started to notice deer with infections, which aren't entirely uncommon. You know, they run into... We're in more of an urban area, so they run into dog situations or perhaps vehicle strikes and or getting stuck in fences. And so we would see wounded deer and respond to the situation. But they started to show up with worse and worse infections, and the infections were pretty, frankly, kind of horrifying. You know, we hadn't seen wounds that had fly larvae in them previously. So as... when we started to really identify, wow, this is a problem that we haven't experienced before, we took some samples, sent them in, and then it came back as positive for being a screwworm. And from there, the mortality rate really climbed high. And there's been deer walking around here that, they're still trying to keep on, but they've got large wounds on them that are being eaten. You know, they're full of fly larvae, and they're really eating the flesh, and it's really uncomfortable for the deer. And it's really a tragic situation for the community down here as well, who are all, you know, really deeply involved with the key deer down here.
Wow, sorry to hear that. Dr. Kaufman, what's the remedy? I mean, you got rid of them once. Can you get rid of this screwworm again?
We can, and it's actively being pursued at this point. So there's a number of federal and state agencies that are working collaboratively. The primary method for eradication is using what's called the sterile insect technique. And in this method, as how we eradicated them in the first place, we have production facilities down in Panama where we produce these flies by the millions. The flies are irradiated when they're in the pupal stage, which sterilizes the males. Through that process, those males are then brought up and released into the environment. If they mate with a female, and this is where the process is most interesting, that female only mates once. And so if she mates with a sterilized male, she will not produce any viable offspring and essentially ends her genetic line. This is used in combination with other techniques such as trapping that's used for monitoring, as well as removing the flies from the environment, as well as people on the ground checking animals for infestations and assisting those animals to remove those maggots as well.
Can you get this to work fast enough to save the remaining 1,000 deer?
Well, there are other steps that are being taken as well, but this process is going to take about 6 months before they're going to be probably very sure that they've eradicated it. Now, the numbers are not going to be, they're going to progressively drop, but there are other things being done to assist the deer, such as trying to treat them with medications that are going to kill any fly larvae that might establish on them before they get too large, and so it's, but it is a battle, and it's something that is being taken very seriously, and a lot of people are working to try and save this deer.
Chris, let's talk about the methods. Can you give medicine or something to the deer to feed them?
Yeah.
Can you attract, will they come over and take
it? Well, yeah, it's interesting. The key deer here are, they're known for being fairly docile and used to people. And so there's a group out here, the sort of a subset of the population, that will come right up to you and eat out of your hand. And that's something that we've always discouraged in the past, but right now it's kind of working in our favor in this emergency situation. So what we're doing is we're luring them in and using fruits and vegetables. And then when they get up close enough, we're feeding them a piece of bread with a doramectin, and that's an anti-parasitic. Sort of part of the ivermectin drug family, and it will move through the body, and it will work prophylactically, and it will also treat some infections very early stage. So we're trying to get out there and get everything treated and get them on a 7-day rotation, and that's our plan right now. But we've got a whole lot of other things, a lot of other plans that folks are working on. And right now, this is the best one we've got for us, but things are constantly changing, so we may move on to something else tomorrow. But
like what? What would you do besides that?
Well, I mean, I don't know for sure. I've got the experts working on it right now, but it may be that we have to move to a topical solution if we can't get enough to eat. One of the things we've run into is, you know, there's that subset that will eat out of your hand. There's another group that will stay out about 10 or 12 feet, and then we can still throw baits to them, or, you know, the doramectin-laced baits. And then there's another group that won't come anywhere near us, and they're out in the woods. And so it's a real challenge trying to treat those guys, especially when we're trying to do it on a 7-day rotation. Hmm. So for those, we may have to try a different technique. We may have to put out maybe feed blocks that have this drug in it.
Yeah.
Or maybe we figure out a way to get this on them topically and keep those ones safe. And so right now what we did is we started at some keys down at Sugarloaf and Cudjoe Key, where there are some smaller populations of deer that haven't shown positive for screwworm at this point. So we started feeding them this drug first. And then as we got all the ones that we could get down there, we started to move up to Big Pine and No Name Key. And one of the interesting parts of this is as we feed the deer, we're trying to mark them. So we put a little bit of non-toxic paint on them, and that will show that maybe, so on Tuesday, it might have been yellow. So we know that we treated those on Tuesday. The next day, we might treat with blue, so we know Wednesday is blue. So we can kind of track which deer have been treated and which haven't, and when they'll need to get their next dose. But because there's so many deer out there that may not come to us and be easy to get squirted with paint, it doesn't necessarily mean that a deer without paint hasn't been treated. So that's something that we're kind of grappling with right now.
Dr. Kaufman, the Florida Department of Agriculture has declared a state of emergency. There's a quarantine for the Keys, and people are advised to have their pets checked if they're leaving that area. Is that a threat to people's pets? Is it a big threat?
It is a threat, although it's much less than to the wildlife, and that's really because people interact with their pets and will see that they have a wound and perhaps even notice there might be maggots in it. To date, there have been very few. I think I'm aware of one dog that was confirmed as positive and a couple of others that were possibly infested earlier. But everything else that has been found, is, as I understand it, has been a wild animal. But it is critical that we keep the infestation from spreading and keep it in particular off of the peninsula of Florida, where we have a much more diverse wildlife as well as our domestic livestock. And that's why it's important that people present their animals to be inspected. This is not an instance where it's a disease. It is not. These maggots are removed, the animal is treated and made better, and the animal continues. The animals that you're hearing that are being euthanized are animals that the infection has gotten so bad that the animal can't be rescued. And that's really not generally going to be the case for anyone that has a pet that's infested. You would see that well ahead of time.
Well, considering about Zika virus as such a problem in the Miami area, you don't want this coming up, as you say, to the peninsula and infecting other wildlife outside of the Keys. I want to thank both of you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck in your efforts.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Dr. Philip Kaufman, Associate Professor of Veterinary Entomology, University of Florida, Gainesville. Chris Eggleston, Acting Manager of the National Key Deer Refuge on Big Pine Key. Support for Science Friday comes from EXO. EXO as an exoskeleton makes protein bars out of cricket flour. It is way better for our planet because it's nearly 80 times more resource efficient to grow 1 gram of cricket protein than it is to raise a gram of beef protein. Crickets require far less water, feed, and land, and they can be raised virtually anywhere. What's more, crickets are a lean and complete protein and packed full of micronutrients like iron, calcium, and omega-3s. And maybe most importantly, EXO bars are created with simple, all-natural ingredients, and they're delicious. A real favorite is the blueberry vanilla. And for you autumn lovers, there's apple cinnamon. EXO, that's EXO, wants everyone to try these bars. So if you go to exoprotein.com/science, you can get their sampler pack with all their most popular flavors for less than $10. EXO bars. 80% of the world now eats bugs. Will you? This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Before NASA, there was NACA back in the 40s, 1940s and 50s. It was the National Advisory Committee on Aeronautics with headquarters at the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia. NACA's job was to make more efficient airplanes. Had engineers who worked to solve problems like how to break the sound barrier, what to do about the sonic boom that you created. And supporting those engineers, or working as hard as they could to be those engineers, were dozens of African-American women mathematicians whose contributions could have easily been lost to history, except for Margot Lee Shetterly. Margot Lee Shetterly grew up in Hampton. Her father was part of the scientific community, and these women passed through her house, and they were part of her community. And in her new book about NASA's African-American human computers, as they were known, she writes, "Growing up in Hampton, the face of science was brown like mine." Margot Lee Shetterly joins us today. She's the author of Hidden Figures, The American Dream, and the Untold Story of the Black Women Mathematicians Who Helped Win the Space Race. She's also founder of the Human Computer Project, which works to archive these women's stories online. Welcome to Science Friday, Margot.
Hi, Ira. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you. Also with us is Dr. Christine Darden, one of the NASA women Margot writes about, former computer, former engineer, former director of the Office of Strategic Communications and Education at Langley. Welcome back, Dr. Darden.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be here.
Margot, tell us what drew you to this story. I can easily see from the book that it was all family related, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, Ira. In fact, as I mentioned in the book, I knew a lot of the women that I wrote about in the book, but also I knew that there were Black scientists and Black engineers and female scientists and engineers, which is, you know, we talk about our perception of who can be or who is a scientist. I was really fortunate to have those role models growing up. So, and it was really, as I mentioned, this moment with my husband. We were home for Christmas. My dad was talking about a number of the women, including Katherine Johnson, which is a name that many people know, I think, at this point, and her contributions to Langley, to NASA, to the space program. And he, you know, was like, wait a minute, this is a huge story and nobody knows about it. So for me, it was something that to a certain extent I took for granted. And that one moment really sort of saw that those women and that history and how I grew up with fresh eyes. And, you know, once I started asking questions like, well, how did they come to Langley? Yeah. Why were there so many Black women there? I just couldn't stop chasing the story.
Well, take us back to the 30s. How did NACA first begin hiring women to do math and then start hiring Black women? What was the motivation there?
Right. So as you mentioned earlier, the job of the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics was to make planes faster, you know, more efficient, safer. And there was a lot of testing involved in that. Sometimes they did free flight testing, which was, you know, they'd attach instruments to plane and fly the plane. Sometimes they parked the plane or plane parts, a wing or the body of a plane in a wind tunnel and blew the air over the part or over the plane to simulate flight. But in either circumstance, there was so much data from the instruments that had been attached to the plane that, you know, all of these numbers needed to be analyzed the same way, you know, we have lots of data in so many different disciplines these days. It needs to be analyzed. It's tedious work, but it's really necessary. And the engineers were doing it. So what they decided is, what if we had a computing pool the same way we have a secretarial pool, and we'll distribute this work to the members of the pool? So in 1935, they hired five women, in this case, they were white women, to start processing all of this data that came from the aeronautical testing. And it was a hit. The women were extremely good at their jobs. It freed the engineers to do things other than the computing. There was a real bonus in the fact that they paid the women less than they paid the men, even if they were doing very similar work. And it created huge efficiencies in the aeronautical research industry. And this is a time when airplanes are becoming, you know, more and more a part of the military. And then on the eve of World War II, you know, obviously the airplane was a very significant weapon of war. It would go on to influence the balance of victory in World War II. So the Black women started coming in 1943, and this was 2 years after a man named A. Philip Randolph, who was a civil rights leader, whose name not as many people know today, but who was very well known in those days, really pushed Roosevelt to open the then segregated federal government, the civil service, defense industry, open those jobs to African Americans. So 2 years after Roosevelt signed an executive order desegregating the government, the first five Black women walked into the gates at Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory.
Mm-hmm. And Christine Darden, you were one of these women. What is your biggest lasting impression that you keep with you about that job?
Well, the job that I had, I was a little later than 1943, and we were getting ready to walk on the moon. That was the most exciting thing that was happening when I went to NASA. And I actually went into a computing pool that was that had done all of the tests for the reentry of the Apollo back into the atmosphere in the work that I did. So just to learn what they were doing at NASA was exciting to me. I didn't really even know what engineers did until I got there and I saw what they were doing. And I was actually, you know, doing work for them and understanding a bit what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever aspire to become an engineer while you were working there?
Oh, yes, I did. I, in fact, started to ask my bosses and everything about going to school. And I ultimately went back and got a PhD in mechanical engineering at George Washington University.
Mm-hmm. And how many women were working with you at any one time? I'm trying to picture your atmosphere there. And I know, reading from Margot's book, that back in the segregation days, there was sort of like a dual life you were living. One is a computer or an engineer, and then you would go into the cafeteria. And Margot, you talk about this in the book, and then there'd be a segregated area where the women couldn't sit with the white people.
Yeah, I just to be clear, the segregated era really lasted till the end of the NACA era. So it really, when the first black women started in 1943, they did have segregated bathrooms, they had a segregated cafeteria, and they actually worked in a segregated office, which was called the West Area Computing Office. But when the Russians launched Sputnik in 1957, which really precipitated the change of the NACA to NASA, the space agency that we know today. That's really when the segregated facilities mm-hmm. came to an end. So, and that happened 10 years before Dr. Darden got to the mm-hmm. center.
Mm-hmm. You focus on just a few of these women: Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughan, Mary Jackson. What about these women made their stories important to tell in this book?
Well, first of all, they spent their entire careers, finished their careers, I should say, because they started their careers as math teachers. But they finished their careers at the Langley Research Center. So it was possible to sort of trace the course of their careers, as they fought to get promoted, as NASA started focusing on space, and not just aeronautics. So that was one of the things. The other thing is, they had some exceptional achievements. In the case of Dorothy Vaughan, what I discovered is that she was actually the first African-American manager, supervisor of any gender at Langley or at NASA, at all of what would become NASA. Mary Jackson was promoted to be an engineer, making her the first black woman to be an engineer at NASA and possibly in the entire United States. Katherine Johnson, she's someone who really stood out for doing the calculations for the early Mercury missions and had, a long career, storied career at Langley. And then Dr. Darden came in and stood on the shoulders of these women and made, superb achievements in the field of supersonic flight and sonic boom. So, all of those characteristics, and then the fact that in so many ways these women's lives intersected other aspects of the 20th century, mm-hmm. including the civil rights movement, Brown versus Board of Ed decision. So so many aspects of their lives made for good science and good storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Christine Darden, what are you most proud of having accomplished? What would you say is your single biggest accomplishment at NASA when you were there?
Well, my first task when I became an engineer was to develop a computer program that would give us insight into how to design an airplane for minimized sonic boom. And I developed that program and spent the next 15 or 20 years actually using that program, designing models, testing them, making changes when we weren't quite right, and ultimately doing flight test. And hopefully that those same theories might be actually demonstrated in an airplane if NASA can get an X-plane for supersonic flight in the next few years.
And how did the political events, I mean, of the times you were there, right there in the 60s, there were tremendous political events going, 64, 65, the civil rights movement. Did you feel that shaping your job at all at NASA?
Well, of course, I did live through very turbulent times, and I lived through exciting times. You know, also the Sputnik was was shot up when I was in high school also. And so I think one of the I had been in an all black environment pretty much until I came to NASA. My entire education was segregated. And so when I got there and I started thinking that I really wanted to pursue engineering and work as an engineer and I wanted to go to school, one of the toughest decisions to make was I knew that the others in my class would be six or seven white males, and I would be the only female and the only black. And that worried me a long time. And I finally said, I'm going to do it. And I did it. And nobody spoke to me for a while. But after the first few weeks and after a test or two, a couple of the guys came over and said, hey, you want to join our study group? And so it moved on from there, and I was focusing on doing what I was there to do.
Yeah, and Margo, it must have been sort of the same kind of breakthrough for Katherine Johnson to be trusted with creating the calculations that first put John Glenn into orbit and brought him back in 1962.
Yeah, I mean, this is an almost unbelievable thing. I mean, we have a situation where in Virginia, which is still a segregated state, you know, this was a time when not that long before that, women weren't allowed to serve on juries. A lot of states didn't allow women to get credit cards in their own names. You know, and yet here is Katherine Johnson, a black woman working with white male engineers and saying, you know, raising her hand and saying, listen, I'm the one to finish the report that describes the orbital flight, you know, that was upcoming. She did that in 1959. And, you know, she was the one that, you know, when they were counting down to the February 1962 orbital flight of astronaut John Glenn, and, you know, you can imagine the kind of checklists and anxiety around that. You know, this is a very complicated mission that they had. And one of the checklist items was having Katherine Johnson basically take a set of data that went through the computer, you know, basically simulating the upcoming flight, having Katherine Johnson take the raw numbers and run them through all of the equations that have been programmed in the computer by hand to make sure that the computer's results were the same as her results. So John Glenn, what he actually said was, listen, get the girl to do it. And at that time, all of the women, regardless of their age or background, were commonly referred to as the girls.
I've got to interrupt you just to remind our stations that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
So John Glenn trusted Katherine Johnson's numbers, you know, as one of the preflight checklists, you know, and this is, it's an amazing story.
Did he do this personally, ask for this?
I've checked so many different sources on that, for this, from Katherine Johnson to, you know, the engineers and even astronauts who asked John Glenn in retrospect about that moment. And he asked for the girl. You know, and everybody, you know, they knew that she was the particular girl working in that group and that the engineers that were very closely associated with that particular endeavor would sort that particular task over to her.
Mm-hmm. Christine Darden, how did your work life and your home life compare? Was it easier, you know, to be black at NASA or in Hampton, Virginia?
Probably at NASA at the time, because as she told the story about a woman couldn't get a credit card, I tried to buy a violin one year, and they told me my husband had to come in and pay for it. I says, he's not paying for it. You know, so there we had lots of incidences like that in Hampton.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a famous incident, Margot, in your book about taking away the sign at the lunch at the lunchroom there, at the table, the segregation sign.
That's true. Now, that's something that happened in the very early days. And there was a woman named Miriam Mann who worked at Langley until 1967. She was in the very first group. There was a group of 11 women who had gone through a war training class, and five of those were the very first women to go and take a seat in the West Area Computing Office. And those women, they were the first Black professionals at all of what would become NASA, and they had, you know, there had been Black cafeteria workers and groundskeepers, but they were there with the engineers. They had a separate table, and Miriam Mann refused. You know, every day she took the sign that said "Colored Computers" on the table. She took it, she put it in her purse, and she took it home, just refusing to acknowledge the segregation until one day the sign disappeared. And, you know, it seems like a small thing, but it really is a great thing for establishing their dignity in that professional workplace.
I want to thank you both for being with us this hour. Christine Darden, former NASA mathematician engineer. The book is Hidden Figures, and it's out there. Founder of Human Computer Project at Charlottesville, Virginia. Hey, Ira here. You want a quick and geeky way to celebrate Science Friday's 25th anniversary? Well, just pull out your smartphone and text a pledge to 646-846-4724. That's 646-846-4SCI. Just text that number with the amount you want to pledge and then complete your pledge. It's an easy way to support us in our 25th year. That's 646-846-4724. And thanks. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The election season is mercifully drawing to a close. We can all breathe a sigh of relief. This means that the pundits and the pollsters are ramping up their presidential predictions. 538.com is forecasting an 86% to 13% split for Secretary Clinton. The New York Times gives Hillary a 92% chance of winning. Fox News is putting Donald Trump up by 1 point. What does any of this tell us? Can we pull out any useful information from these stats? And how can we make polling more predictive in the future? My next guest is here to walk us through all of this. Scott Keeter is a senior survey advisor at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
Now Pew does a lot of polling of people. How does the data for these presidential polls differ from any of the other public opinion surveys?
It's really very similar. You start with a sample of the general public, and then you hone down the sample until you find people who are registered to vote and hopefully likely to vote. And that's where you make your election estimates. But you're talking to the same people that you would talk to for any other kind of survey. If you were asking them about their health status or economic condition or opinion on issues.
Mm-hmm. There are lots of poll aggregators out there, basically polls of polls. Do these tend to be more accurate than any individual poll?
Well, they're only as good as the input. And so to the extent that polling in general is accurate, then the aggregators are going to be accurate. The real advantage to the aggregators is that they work on the assumption that, you know, any individual poll can have various kinds of random errors that cause them not to be perfectly accurate. And by combining polls, you sort of offset those random errors. I mean, just in most basic terms, if you're stacking 10 1,000-person polls on top of each other, you end up with 10,000 people in your sample. And by, you know, the laws of probability, you should have a more precise estimate of whatever it is that you're trying to measure. And, of course, that is going to work as long as what you're putting in there is not garbage. The fact is that polling is still pretty accurate, especially in presidential elections in this country, and aggregations of polling tend to be very, very accurate. So I do trust them. I look at them myself pretty much every day, like everybody else right now.
How do you explain the occasional outlier? For example, there was an LA Times poll that put Donald Trump way ahead that broke from what other polls were saying. It was an outlier. How does that happen?
We don't know whether in the end the LA Times poll is going to turn out to be more accurate than all of the others or is actually going to be an outlier. But we know why it's coming in the way it is, and it's largely a result of a weighting decision that they make. All polls weight the data to try to make them match up with what's known to be true about the population. But they make one particular adjustment that no other pollster that I'm aware of does, which is to try to weight the data to correspond with the actual margin of the 2012 presidential election. And for a variety of reasons, that seems to make the poll more Republican in its sample composition than all of the other polls that don't include that adjustment. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's the right thing. I don't think it's the right thing, but that is a very respectable poll, and it has, you know, very good people working for it. And so we'll just have to see whether that turns out to be the aberration or prescient.
How do we know that people being polled are telling us the truth about what they're doing or telling us how they're really voting one way or the other? And I'm thinking also of something called the hidden Trump effect or the shy Trump effect.
It's long been a worry in the polling profession that people are hiding their opinions. And the fact that the track record in American presidential elections in particular has been so accurate, and that it's not where the errors have occurred, they have tended not to be consistently in a conservative or a liberal direction over the years, gives us a lot of assurance that people are not shading the truth, or at least not systematically doing so. Of course, this was a big controversy in the 1980s and 1990s when something similar seemed to be happening with African-American candidates, where the polls would overestimate how well they were going to do. I was polling in Virginia in 1989 when Douglas Wilder ran for governor there, and the polls consistently overestimated how well he was going to do. He won, but only by a fraction of a point. But then Barack Obama came along, and pollsters were really worried about it, but the polling in 2008 and in 2012 was remarkably accurate. So I don't put a lot of stock in the idea that people who support Donald Trump are afraid to admit it.
You think that the kind of voter is not fearful of saying, I'm a supporter?
Well, anecdotally, I certainly see that. I mean, it's possible that there are some people, given how much controversy there is about his candidacy and the fact that many people in his party, at least at the elite level, have rejected him, that you could imagine some people not owning up to it. But, you know, we just don't have much evidence that that's happened in other cases. So at this point, I guess we could also point to the primaries. The Republican primary polling was not bad. I mean, primary polling is difficult, period, just because of the nature of the electorate. But there were no serious biases of underestimating Trump's support. The underestimation of Trump's support in the primaries came from the pundits.
So the polling was accurate then?
Yes, yes. There is no sign at all. He led from the very beginning. It was very, you know, clear that he had, you know, a solid plurality within the Republican electorate. And, you know, a lot of us, including myself in the beginning, just didn't think that in the end, as people got to know more about him, that he would mm-hmm. he would stay atop. And he did. So this is a situation in which I'm not going to put myself in the class with Nate Silver, but Nate Silver didn't believe it. I didn't believe it. A lot of people didn't believe it. But eventually, you know, the polling was proven right.
Our number 844-724-8255, talking about polling. Is there a time when the history shows that we have reached the spot? We have, you know, where the polls are not going to change certain number of days or weeks out before the election?
I'm a political scientist by training, and, you know, all of us in the profession who study elections tend to think that the fundamentals that drive American politics tend to lock people into their choices quite early. It's not to say that there aren't some people who can be persuaded towards the end, And this election, more than others, perhaps has a lot of that because both of the major party candidates are not very well liked. We see, you know, unusually large percentages of people picking third-party candidates, for example.
Yeah.
But generally speaking, when you get within 2-3 weeks of an election, you don't see very much movement, particularly in the absence of major events. You know, we've just had the third of the three debates. It's hard to imagine what could happen at this point that would radically change the thinking of the public at this point.
Early voting has started in many of the states. I was watching some long lines already in North Carolina, and one of the analysts was saying that by Election Day, 75% may have been voted already. Does that mean we would know the answer to perhaps some of these states by exit polls before the balloting begins that day?
I mean, the pre-election polls, you know, are picking up the fact that there's a lot of people voting early, but it won't be 75%. It will be less than 50%, somewhere between 25% and 40%, perhaps. This is a trend. It's growing. You know, the people who are trying to analyze this right now are doing it by looking at some big data sources, such as the voter files, which are national.
Do we lose him?
I think I'm still here.
Okay, go ahead.
The folks that are looking at early voting are looking at the national voter files, these publicly available records of whether people are registered to vote and whether they've voted. And, you know, they're telling us that in some states the Democrats are doing better than they did in 2012. So, you know, we may get a clearer picture of how the election is going on the basis of that kind of information. But it's still pretty sketchy.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of data out there on people, Twitter and Facebook, social media. Can you use that data to get a better, clearer idea who the voters are and what they're thinking than just by plain polling?
There's a lot of brain power being put into answering that question, but I think that the answer is not clear yet. We certainly know that big data, Twitter, Facebook, other sources, so-called organic data that doesn't come just from questioning people directly, gives us a way to look at a lot of phenomena that polling doesn't do well. For example, we can study networks among people much better with something like Twitter or Facebook than we can with polling, because we may have the entire corpus of the data to work with. And so that tells us a lot about how networks work. We also can measure things that people don't report very accurately, which might even include things like their media consumption. People remember seeing things, or they mm-hmm. don't remember seeing things that they did. But, you know, big data in the form of what apps people are looking at or what things they're viewing in their Facebook feeds may give us better records of that.
Well, Scott, thank you for taking time to be with us today. I learned a lot today, and we'll keep an eye on the polls and on what you guys are doing over at Pew. Scott Keeter is a senior survey advisor at the Pew Research Center in Washington, D.C. Back in August, astronomer Konstantin Batygin was on the show talking about NICU, the newly discovered Kuiper Belt object with a really strange orbit. It moves backwards at a 110-degree tilt to the rest of the solar system. Really strange. And Konstantin is an expert on Planet 9, another mysterious planet body that we know next to nothing about, and we don't even know where it is. So I asked him in that interview if these two objects could be related. Could Planet 9 have something to do with the weirdness of NICU's orbit?
I want to say, you know, I'm not saying it was Planet 9, but between you and me, it was totally Planet 9.
well, everything in Planet 9 is Planet 9 with this guy, and he didn't have any evidence at the time to link the two. But he told us this week that he finally has proof. So joining us again for a brief update on the relationship between NICU and Planet 9 is Konstantin Batygin, Assistant Professor of Planetary Science at Caltech. Welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
I'm told you were inspired by our conversation about Niku a few months back to find that proof.
Yeah, indeed. You know, I sort of joked around about it on the show, but then, you know, I went downstairs back to my office, and I thought, you know, I mean, this sounds, of course, like a long shot, but I mean, I might as well, you know, do some numerical experiments. So so that's what I did. You know, then we looked into it deeper with my friend Mike Brown, and we're like, wow, this actually generates not only Niku type orbits. We have one simulated particle that becomes, you know, truly an analog of this 110-degree tilted body. It is quite remarkable.
Wow. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International, talking with Konstantin Batygin. But right now, Niku is too far away from Planet Nine to be affected by it. Well, you know, is how does this happen?
That's right. And that was one of the things that, you know, sort of initially led us to think that this would be a long shot. But what we discovered is a dynamical pathway. We discovered that through something called the Kozai-Ledov effect, what Planet Nine does is it can take very distant orbits, twist them on their side while they're still in the very distant parts of the solar system that are directly affected by Planet Nine's gravity. And then subsequently, these orbits can intersect the orbit of Neptune. And then sort of close encounters with Neptune can subsequently shrink their orbits, kind of pull them in to the inner solar system. So they get produced far away, and then they get shrunk and kind of frozen in these highly inclined, retrograde, very weird states. But the dynamical pathway involves the action of Planet Nine.
So do you feel vindicated?
I guess. I do so on a daily basis.
Do your colleagues believe you when you say this?
You know, I think in this case the proof is in the calculation. I mean, I didn't make this up. There's a, you know, the numerical experiments, the only ingredient they have is gravity, and we know how that works pretty well in the solar system. So I think this is not there's no question that such a pathway exists, provided the existence of Planet Nine.
So I understand in the meantime that you found out that it may have an effect on our solar system that makes our sun look tilted. Is that right?
That's right. One of the great mysteries of the solar system dating back probably 150 years has been the fact that the sun is oblique with respect to the plane of the solar system by 6 degrees. Now, of course, among friends, 6 degrees is not very many degrees. But, you know, 6 degrees is big compared to the mutual inclination between the planetary orbits. So the planetary orbits are flat with respect to one another to less than a degree. And the sun kind of stands out as a strange outlier. So one of the, as we kind of try and go through the solar system and try and look for puzzles that could be tied to Planet Nine, we recognize that this could be one of them.
Hmm.
And that over the course of the solar system's lifetime, over 4.5 billion years, Planet Nine, because it resides on a somewhat tilted orbit, can torque the entire solar system, meaning the planetary orbits, by some number of degrees, which depends on the orbit of Planet Nine and the mass.
Wow.
And that number, if you plug in the numbers that we've calculated from the distant Kuiper belt, turns out to be exactly 6 degrees.
Wow.
Into the correct direction. So
I have to interrupt you there. That's great stuff. You know, we need a new movie, Planet Nine from Outer Space.
That's right. Yeah. I'm working on the script right now.
Konstantin Batygin, assistant professor of planetary science at Caltech. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York.